Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. It's Lockie in the house today, and we are talking about, I was going to say defying gravity, but that's a song from a show, isn't it? Escaping gravity, more correctly. We have done boaty stuff recently, and now we are on to floaty stuff. There is a distinctly Bedfordshire feel to our discussion today, me excepted. Certainly my co-host Chris is up there, and so is what we're talking about. How are you doing, Chris?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
All right. Yeah, hanging in there.
Good, good.
What have we got?
Charlotte and I moved up to Bedford 7 years ago and quickly tapped into the rich history of Bedford itself. And when you come into the town, you cannot miss the Cardington Sheds. So today we are here to talk about the R101 and the Higgins Museum. So, in October 2021 marks the 90th anniversary of the last voyage of the R101 airship, which left Cardington on the 4th of October 1930 and crashed, killing nearly all its 54 passengers, with only 7 survivors. To commemorate the anniversary and to celebrate Bedford's role in airship innovation, Bedford Creative Arts recently unveiled its first element of its ambitious Airship Dreams project. 4 years in the making, Airship Dreams Escaping Gravity has brought its installation to Bedford. Today, we are joined by Lydia Saul, Keeper of Social History at the Higgins Bedford, and Mike Stubbs, the award-winning lead artist behind the ambitious project. Hello, Lydia and Mike. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
Thank
you. So, we mentioned Bedford's proud tradition of airship innovation in our intro. Its tradition is kept alive in recent years by the Airlander 10. Could you tell us and the listeners a bit about the history and what it is about Bedford that made it the home of the airship?
I think it's quite an interesting place to start because a lot of people don't know that Bedford is inextricably linked with the airships and the airships at Cardington. They actually started during the First World War to try and combat the German Zeppelins that were coming and bombing England. And it was the Admiralty commissioned the Short brothers, who were based down at Rochester at the time, to come up to Bedford and to build the sheds and airships R31 and R32 here at Cardington. And they also built a village called Shortstown to house their workers. And the reasons for Bedford was that it was flat, there was space, and the Zeppelins couldn't quite get here as far as this far north at the time, so we were relatively safe from being bombed. Unfortunately, they actually only finished the airships 2 weeks before the end of the First World War. It took such a long time to build the sheds and build the airships. But in the 1920s, there was a new type of scheme, the Imperial Airship Scheme, and these airships started being looked at for commercial luxury travel along with some military side issue things they were doing as well. But the real crux of it was that the Air Minister, Lord Thompson, was really keen to get to a Imperial conference in India, and so the R101 was built and was then commissioned to fly to India. And as you mentioned, sadly, didn't make its destination. I don't know, Mike, did you want to come in here and just talk about your interest in the airships at Cardington?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, my first experiences of lighter-than-air vehicles was as a young boy in Bedford, not far from Brickhill, where you are, Chris. I was sort of between Brickhill and Putney. So it was not unusual to see barrage balloons on the horizon as a child. And then a little bit later, we would, of course, witness the slow drone of the Goodyear blimp. And we'd kind of maybe run out in the garden and have a look at that. That was the experience for many people in Bedford in the late 70s and the 1980s. So quite a rare experience, maybe, in terms of the rest of the country. And then, of course, as you so rightly say at the beginning, the sheds themselves were vast and they loom on the horizon, and they were a place of mystery because not many people got inside them. But we also know that they, apart from housing and having airships constructed within them, they were the home to many activities which were quite diverse, ranging from anti-riot training with the police, parachute training with the Royal Air Force. Numerous pop bands did practices there, including Wet, Wet, Wet. They did setting fire to buildings inside it and then putting them out again with the fire service. So it's quite a rich sort of cultural history within those sheds.
Fantastic. That's really, really interesting.
If we'll talk about the exhibition in a bit more detail in just a sec, but for the uninitiated on the R101, because I think maybe kind of through little bits of documentary and things, there's maybe like a diffusive knowledge of the R101 without a lot of its kind of specifics and kind of what happened to it, crucially as well. So let's talk about that for a second. What are the kind of basic...
One of the key things would be that whereas the Hindenburg was documented on film, and it had a film crew on board and its disaster was documented visually, the R101 basically, when it crashed into the cliff on the coast of France, kind of was not evidenced. Like, there are photographs of the aftermath of the sort of skeleton of its frame embedded in the ground. But the crash itself is sort of invisible in terms of visual history. So that's partially why it doesn't really figure within history making, maybe.
I think we were trying, when we first started the project, we did a little introductory video about the R101, but for anybody who hasn't heard of the R101, it is R for rigid airship, and it was really important to the kind of the Admiralty. The reason why the Cardington sheds are called sheds is because it was through the Admiralty and not through the Royal Air Force. So they're not called hangars, although some people do call them hangars these days, but they are actually known as sheds because they were effectively flying ships. And so they had a shed to house the ship. And so that's why they're called the sheds. The R101 was the largest airship to ever be built in the UK. It was extended. So eventually it was 777 feet long, which was about 3.5 football pitches long. And it would have been dominated the landscape as it took off. And 1929, they completed the airship and it started doing some trial flights. They had some problems with lift, so they added another gas bag. Now, inside the rigid structure, there are gas bags, and those gas bags were filled with hydrogen gas, which we could manually manufacture. There was a big hydrogen plant at Cardington. And this was lighter than air, so it was it gave it a lot of lift. And then it was fueled by sort of diesel engines, and that would power it forward. And then it also had water ballast, so they drop water ballast in order to get some extra height where they needed it. So getting that balance right between the amount of lift and the weight of the ship and the amount of fuel you had was quite an interesting conundrum at the time, and is some of the issue about what happened to it. Lord Thompson was involved, and as I say, there was this big diplomatic conference, really important nationally and internationally, and this was going to be, they were so much quicker than ships on the sea. You know, the ships on the sea would take months potentially to get to India. 3 weeks was how long the airship would take to get there. They were really quick compared to any other aircraft at the time. So this was really important, and they could be quite luxurious as well. So Lord Thompson wanted to bring, well, do you want to explain this, Mike, the reason, things that you found inspiring about this particular story that have influenced some aspects of your artwork?
Carry on.
Lord Thompson was the Air Minister of the day, wasn't he? Was he the Air Minister of the day?
Yeah, Lord Thompson was the Air Minister at the time. Sorry, I should have said that. Lord Thompson was the Air Minister at the time, and he was a real driving force behind the airship going on that particular journey at that particular moment in time. So it was scheduled to leave Bedford on the 4th of October and then to arrive. And he wanted to take gifts for the diplomatic conference, and so he took two very large rugs, one of which he wanted to be laid in the lounge of the R101, and the other was to be as a gift. But of course, they were really heavy, so the poor crew were there taking biscuits out of biscuit tins, we've heard, in order to try and reduce the amount of weight, in order to get that balance right that we were talking about. And also, the other thing that happened that evening was the weather was not as good as they would have liked. Airships really do like not too windy, not much rain, really nice calm weather. And so unfortunately, as the airship left on the 6 o'clock in the evening at the on the 4th of October, some rain came in across as it was crossing the channel. It was pretty heavily laden with all the things that were on board and all the people that were on board. 54 people were on board, and unfortunately, yes, did crash into a hillside in Beauvais in France, just after this, coming up to 2 o'clock in the morning. And quite suddenly, they just lost quite a lot of lift. And unfortunately, because the engines were pushed up into the body of the airship, the people were inside the body of the airship in the accommodation. It caught alight and everyone pretty much died, unless they were very fortunate and had water ballast fall on them, which kept them from catching up fire, basically. So unfortunately, the whole ship, all we had was the metal girders on the hillside, and a few people were rushed to the town hall at Beauvais and given some medical attention. And so actually there were eight people initially survived, but then only six of those eight people actually entirely survived. Two people passed away afterwards. So it was a very disastrous. I mean, there was many people on board, both staff, crew, and some VIPs, like Lord Thompson, that were killed outright. And so they decided they better not fly any more airships after that point in time, because it had been such a disaster. And of course, a lot of the very skilled engineers and designers were also on board. So it was a real tragedy for everyone.
Wow, that's fascinating. Such history there. So based on that information you've given us, how does this lead on to Airship Dreams Escaping Gravity at the William Harper Gallery, which was set up by Mike?
Well, in 2000, I made an art exhibition in Bedford about car culture and car racing. So as a young man, I spent far too much unhealthy attention on cars and bikes. And of course, that raises a question about gender and identity. But as a contemporary artist who's, you know, done work and made work and shown it all around the world, that was the first time I'd made work in Bedford, my hometown. And then later on, working with Bedford Creative Arts, I was invited sort of 15 years later to propose a new project for Bedford. And I started a conversation with Annie Bacon, who then worked at BCA, and then with Lydia, about a project which would sort of expose this sort of fascination, really, with airships. And in a sense, the story of the R101 specifically, because for me, it's full of metaphor and symbolism. It's an emblem, in a sense, of hubris. Itself as a device, it's both a conceptual surface to project ideas onto. And then in a sense, it's a sort of utopian, futuristic version that people could aspire to. And that's, you know, in a sense, that's part of our human condition to want to will something better for everybody for the future. But of course, then when we see all the black and white photographs in the archive of men in top hats getting on board and women doing the work of scraping the animal skins to make the gas bags inside, you realise that this is also a story of class and privilege. And for me, that coincided with the referendum and Brexit. So for me, this is also related to my identity in relationship to Bedford, a small town in England, a small island, and its relationship to the rest of the world. The fact that the the program was called the Imperial Airship Program. And of course, its destination when it crashed was Karachi. And this is prior to the partition of India. It's a sort of massive image of Britain's attempt to kind of establish itself as a colonial player again after the part failure of the First World War. And unfortunately, we're still seeing many of those kind of colonial imperial manoeuvres play out in contemporary life right now with Afghanistan or Iraq. Things haven't changed much. So for me, this is a very contemporary work. This is not celebrating a history of the airship at all. It's actually using it as a metaphor to discuss contemporary issues. The fact that the contemporary work sits alongside the historic project is really, really interesting. So that Lydia and myself work very closely with a guy called Dan Birchmore, who was originally the shed manager at Cardington, and he trained parachutists and he was an expert in dirigibles. But in his later life, he became a curator of the airship collection. And then when that airship collection was sort of moved from the shed, he then established a collection of his own in his garden shed on retirement. And he made that available to the public for a good 5 years with Jean, his partner. Now, Dan, unfortunately, is no longer with us, having died fairly recently. But we did have good contact with him, and he was a sort of massive source of anecdote and assured history, along with the Airship Heritage Trust, with Alistair, et cetera. So the museum show, in a sense, is a kind of community curated exhibition of items and ephemera donated by community members, enthusiasts, people passionate about the Airship Programme and Cardington. And in itself, it started out as being an art project itself alongside the new media installation. But because of we having to do this under a pandemic, it became more virtual, and Lydia and her team at BCA had to, had to really kind of drive that forward under fairly difficult circumstances.
Well, I was going to kind of ask about the pandemic. I guess sort of keen mathematicians who are listening will twig that 1930 to 2021 is 91 years, and so yeah you've clearly had a bit of a kick on there. What's the challenge? Because I know from my research, getting into archives recently has been very, very difficult. And so how has that kicked you back?
Well, obviously, the event itself was postponed for 12 months. It was intended to take place in 2020 for the 90th centenary, you're correct. Then the process of making the work with five collaborators virtually, you know, so just to give you a quick heads up on what Escape and Gravity looks like, it's a massive projection with a spatialized audio environment. So my background was being more influenced by stuff like Kraftwerk or Massive Attack or U2 in terms of their skill at producing audiovisual shows. So I'm very much into new media and cinematic projection. So this is really kind of cutting edge new media. But I guess the process that we had to make it was working in a games engine called Unreal, which Fortnite's built in. And it meant that a team of new media collaborators, some of which had never met, were working just like this in little Zoom boxes between Leeds, Liverpool, Doncaster, and London. At the beginning of that process, it was extremely challenging, you know, not just because of trying to make a piece together virtually, but we were all suffering, as many people were in society, with death, fear, and unknowing, really. And I think that also did influence the work itself. There are direct references within the script and the text to being in this pandemic state. And there's quite a lot, you know, like really the work is quite poetic. like it uses words and it uses images and it uses musical composition, and it's all kind of woven together. Likewise, the carpets that Lydia described, we took that as a cue, and there are carpets that you can sit on to watch the work, as well as deck chairs. The deck chairs are sort of sourced from images from the flight deck of the R101. And the carpets, again, they've got maps cut out of them of a map of the world with kind of some sort of routes and cities marked out there as to the ambition for the Imperial Airship Programme dominating the globe. So it's got sculptural elements as well. It's not just purely an image projection and audio.
I found it really fascinating, actually. And I love the way you combine the past and the present, and visually stunning as well. And I'd recommend anybody to come to Bedford and watch this installation and visit the project. But could you possibly tell us a bit more about how you you got the members of the public involved in the actual exhibition? And there's a number of artifacts in there. I particularly like the Donald and Reginald Clark image of the two young boys in their Sunday best, who were taken down by their dad to look at the R101. There's a lot of artifacts in there, and really interesting things. How did you collect all these together?
I'll pass this on to Lydia in a second, but like when I see those images of the little boy in short trousers, you know, that could have been me as well. And I just again want to sort of emphasize that thing that this was, you know, so I can remember my sister being asked whether she wanted to come and see the Goodyear blimp, and she said no. So that there is a significant issue around gender that needs drawing out of this story. And so dads and lads love technology. And it's a way of also educating adults through children, of course. I think, you know, the access to the Airship Heritage Trust, initially through Den and then through Alistair, was really significant. But they've been a sort of superb collaborator to work with. Without them, we wouldn't really have been able to do it. We also ran a week's workshop at the library, Bedford Library, which we're sort of mucking about with AR and VR and video and stuff. So you know, it's been a sort of slow process. But I'd like Lydia, really, because Lydia had to lead this in terms of the delivery end for the museum show.
I think, yeah, I mean, initially with the pandemic, it was quite difficult. So we put a call out online and through social media and the website and through Bedford Creates, Creative Arts. And we started with an idea around unboxing, which had sort of come from thinking about sort of objects that people might have at home in their attics or their own sheds, and asking people to share their stories digitally. So we did a few Zoom interviews with different people that came forward, which was really lovely. And partially from the inspiration through Den being interviewed by Mike, actually, and wanting to kind of, you know, encourage people through Den's passion for airships, and see what people had at home. And then there was a few people where we had stories that had come forward, it's sort of over the years that we've not had opportunity to feature. So we had a lovely collection of different stories that have not been told, from actually, and Mike was talking about class and stories that haven't been told. So from the carpenters, for example, that had made the airships, so the R, you know, the R38 and the R101, there was a wonderful tool chest that is on display that we hadn't been able to display before. And then that story that the couple, George Cook and his wife, they actually ran the Cardington Arms, the King's Arms at Cardington, I should say, sorry. So that was a wonderful piece of local history. And also talking about the women, because it's saying dads and lads, but actually a lot of the women were the people that Mike mentioned that actually had made the airship. And one of the people that we discovered through the Airship Heritage Trust was a photograph album that had been sent to Alistair Lawson, who's chair, and by a gentleman called Alan Slater. And that photograph album was really significant. It was by a lady called Miss DC Forster, and she was one of the senior staff at Cardington. And she looked after the outer coverettes. So they were the people that made the outer cover for the R101. And there were pictures in this album that have never been seen. And we also discovered that Miss Cochrane Foster was actually the girl in the deck chair. So we have deck chairs in the artwork, and we discovered there was some press images of women in a deck chair with who we discovered Sergeant Johnson behind her, one of the officers. And it was wonderful to see those pictures. And there's also a picture of a sports day of the women taking part, which actually, obviously, the Higgins is based at the Higgins Brewery in Bedford. And there's a wonderful advertising banner behind them saying that that was the beer tent at the sports day. So there was lovely, lovely things like that. And also a wonderful woman called Hilda Lyon, who was actually one of the designers for the R101, who hadn't had much attention in the past, we feature her quite prominently within those stories. We feature some people that have survived the R101 crash, and we also feature some people who unfortunately passed away, like Arthur Burton, and some people that were involved in airship flight. We had a wonderful gold watch come in from Harold, it's connected with Harold Rowe, who had helped to get the R-33, which had broken away from its mast, back from the North Sea. And a handful of people in 1925 were given these gold watches in honour of their bravery for retrieving the R-33 when it had been blown away in a storm from its mast. So yeah, there's some wonderful stories that had come out, and really grateful to all the community curators that shared the stories and put those into words for us to share with our public. So
I'm just going to sort of take you back a second, just to kind of the survivor accounts, because this to me is just the most terrifying thing in the entire world. I mean, I'm terribly scared of heights and flying anyway, just as a, which is quite ironic as a very tall man, but what
you can't tell that.
Okay, you just zoom, it doesn't quite work.
You can only see the top half of your body.
I promise I'm very tall. What do we get from these accounts? Because this wasn't even the first big airship crash either. Wasn't there one a few years earlier? Was it the R-38 I'm thinking of?
R-38 about a year earlier.
Yeah.
Recently been commemorated, where it crashed into the River Hull, having been sort of stationed at Howden. But that one exploded in the sky in front of a large audience. But again, wasn't recorded on film.
Goodness. And I think you're right. There are people that survived those crashes, such as there was Sky Hunt, as he was known, and Wally Potter, which is one of my favourite stories, actually, and tragic stories of the R101 crash. They were actually in the control car at the time of the crash. So they were in charge, driving that ship, Sky Hunt had survived the R-38 and Wally Potter. They'd both survived the R-38 crash. So they were back on board another airship, not scared. but really sadly, both lost their lives. Now, amazingly, Sky Hunt got out of the R-101 crash. Oh. And the last thing he was heard saying was, "I'm going back for Wally." And we never saw him again after that. Mm. So he went back in to try and save his mate and sadly lost his life too. So that is true bravery. and so the six people that did survive, I think, genuinely, only they can really know what that was like. It was interesting. Joe Binks, he survived the crash. His son, Derek, still lives locally and was interviewed very kindly for the project. And his dad continued to work at Cardington on those hydrogen plant with the various balloons that were going up his whole life. He went back and lived in Shortstown his whole life with Mr. Bell, another engineer he survived alongside. And they met up every year at the King's Arms and raised a pint to all the people and friends they'd lost on the R101 crash. So they were, true heroes, really. And their vision and determination just, they really did believe that the airships were wonderful, even after seeing them crash and experiencing that. So
you might like to add as well that of course, I've read various accounts of what actually is supposed to have happened from different perspectives. There's a kind of strong sense that the experts, the scientists, the engineers weren't really listened to in terms of the speed of which the air trials took place. So in a sense, the kind of political ambition for the craft to be extended in length, to give it a kind of, be able to take a bigger payload, carry more gifts. And then having made this structural change, the suggestion was it needed a longer air trial period, but that was rushed. For me, that's an important part of the story, really.
Yeah, I mean, from my kind of limited understanding of it, it's not quite like the Hindenburg where you just see it all go up in flames all of a sudden, is it? It's definitely a crash that you see where it almost like noses down.
I think Mr. Bell described it as more of a crunch.
Oh, really?
So it was actually didn't hit it actually that fast, it just been losing height, and it was you know very dark, but also not very good weather. There was a lot of rain, they talk about it actually not hitting the hillside very. The reason why it caused such devastation was because the engines were underneath, as you can, you know, on the airship, and were forced up into the body. And unfortunately, so some of the survivors were actually in the smoking room because it was lead lined, so it protected them from the fire. And the others, as I say, had water ballast fall on them, so they were wet, so that helped. It was incredible. It's interesting that there are lots of theories, and I'm not sure we'll ever really know what caused that to crash.
All right, well let's move things on then, because you mentioned, because I'm thinking about, you know, 1920s and 30s aviation, and people like Amy Johnson come to mind, really. So actually kind of it's not just men. And you mentioned Hilda Lyon, who was a big deal back then in the world of kind of aerodynamics, and wasn't she? Let's talk about her for a second. What made her so special?
She's really interesting. I think not many people know about her. She was born actually up in Market Wheaton, not far from Howden in Yorkshire and Beverley. And then she was trained and graduated from Cambridge in 1918 and went on to be a member at the Royal Aeronautical Society in 1922. So she'd already had a real, you know, kind of great accolade sort of and training. She then joined the Royal Airship Works in 1925 and started doing quite a lot of research around transverse frames and the shape of airships. So she was the person behind the lion shape, which is kind of this teardrop type shape that influenced these range of airships. So that was really significant. In design terms, it was incredible. And so she was the first woman to receive the Memorial Prize for the R-38. There was a Memorial Prize set up, I think, after the crash and things. And so she was the first woman to receive that. But she went on, she actually wasn't on board during the crash, so she survived afterwards, which was probably as well. But she went on to actually study in America at the Massachusetts. She got various scholarships and also got in Germany. And I think she only came back because her mother was taken ill. So she, in 1937, she comes back, and then she's able to continue to work from home effectively, which is very forward thinking given the situation we find ourselves in now. She does quite a lot of academic research over that time, and then joins the Royal Aircraft Establishment at Farnborough and continues until 1946, when she has an operation, unfortunately passes away. So she is an amazing role model for young women, and if we're thinking there were only male engineers around, she was definitely one of the exceptions and a brilliant engineer and designer. So yeah.
What was she working on after the airships? Because surely after R101,
I think a number of the principles that she discovered or kind of instated were then translated into nautical engineering.
Okay.
And yeah, also, there was some aeroplanes as well. So during the Second World War, she worked on stability analysis of the Hurricane's rudder. That was her principal area of research. So, yeah, she was very highly regarded.
Good. What an amazing woman.
Yeah.
So with all this amazing content for the 90th anniversary, how is Bedfordians going to see this? Have you had a lot of interest in it? Because having come from London and moved here, I really, really tapped into the rich history of this town. And it needs to be told. So let's bring people to your exhibition.
Okay, well, obviously launching a show during the pandemic is tricky. This is the first time that Bedford has shown a contemporary artwork of this kind ever. So it's a first for the Higgins Museum to work at this scale, actually, or work with an ambitious technological media work. I have got a little clip here running. If you want to hit, I don't know if you've watched any of the Instagram stuff, Andy.
We're just doing audio on here at the moment, but we can certainly put some links up on our History Hack channels for
okay,
you.
Okay, let's do that. But so basically, there are sort of media assets that you could show around a bit, and you could help share it. That would be useful.
Excellent.
In terms of the show itself, there were plans and intentions to do quite an ambitious Sonne Lumiere event as well this autumn. We still want to do that, but at the moment we've basically run out of funding because of the delay through the pandemic. But the Castle Mound outside the Higgins makes an incredible site for, like, at one stage we were going to rent a blimp, we were going to use lasers and video projection into the sky. There were going to be various community members who've taken place, you know, quite a few sort of young people's workshops aligned with this exhibition. And they were going to do kind of work leading to this sort of big public extravaganza. That's all postponed, at least. I'm still hoping it takes place next year. The exhibition is on until the end of November. It's free, which is incredible. It's 40 minutes from London on the train. Bedford is extremely accessible. And so there's regular train service. We're hoping it'll sort of put Bedford on the map as being a place where kind of, you know, really exciting contemporary art can take place.
And I think also, just to let people know, we are planning some workshops. So if you're interested, we were planning some workshops for Bedford Fun Palaces, which is a national initiative, actually, the Fun Palaces Weekend on the 2nd and 3rd, which is just coming up to the 91st anniversary of the airship flying. And so we're hoping to do some sound workshops with Roger Illingworth, who took part in producing the sound for the artwork, and also Anne-Marie Abbott, who did an awful lot of work with Shortstown School, which was wonderful to work with them, and Bedford College, who also produced some fantastic posters that were both inspired sort of past, present and future that are on display at the Higgins as well. So there's quite a lot of community collaboration there as well. So if you want to have a go at making your own little model airship, Anne-Marie is going to be doing that. So there'll be some time slots to book in on the Higgins website coming up soon on the second of October, and then we're also we've had some brilliant feedback actually in the gallery, so I do encourage people to come and see the contemporary artwork, because lots of different people are experiencing it, and from young five-year-olds dancing in the gallery and having a whale of a time to older people really being amazed and inspired by it, and I think also really appreciating the community stories that have been shared that they just didn't know anything about, you know, sort of some of the men and women that have, you know, made the airships, and thinking about how we commemorate in the future as well. We'd love this to be a kind of a stepping off point to building up to the 100th anniversary in 2030, and as Mike said, you know, it'd be wonderful to do a big event and to gather more interest interest in the community. So yeah, that's kind of where we're headed with it, really.
I suppose it's nice, isn't it? You've got things like the Sonny Lumiere idea to kind of bring out, or you're keeping your powder dry almost for the 90th, and then you get to unleash something massive for the 100th, which would be awesome. And in the meantime, dancing with 5-year-olds and kind of having
exactly.
fun, or old people, whoever. Yeah, that will work too. I suppose, like, to sum up, I think the R101 for me, yeah, you're right, Mike, and when you say there's this element of hubris to it, but it's also just, it feels to me like a missed opportunity, because you've clearly got tremendously talented individuals working on this, and there was the potential. I mean, in terms of the concept, the idea of being able to move large distances relatively quickly, certainly compared to ships at the time.
Can I read a little bit to you?
By all means, do. Go.
A short paragraph. Okay, here you go. So these are some of the lines that feature within part of the soundtrack, as written by myself. I am your compass. I sense the weight of your body. The body and land I will conquest, your fantasy factory. I need less ballast. I watch your magic, your transformation, fabric, rope, gas. In this void, I dreamt, leapt, and hoped. You fill this void. Ideas, matter, future, the weight of a rug, the weight of biscuits, a map of the world.
Yeah, I think you've got this really nice blend of art and technology and culture, which just sounds great. And it's tough not to feel kind of excited, but also kind of sad about the R101. And it sounds like this exhibition is hitting that. So yeah, reasons to be cheerful in Bedford. This is one. Absolutely, go and see it, guys. Is there anything else that you'd like to say now in a quick one-liner to get people along to it?
Well, there may be a forum on the 23rd of September. It's scheduled, but I'm literally in a text conversation right now with BCA about whether we can get enough speakers on the day. So if we can confirm that with you via email. As Lydia says, that there are going to be workshops. We're going to also, because it's built in Unreal, we can play it live using a games controller. So we might be doing, as one of the labs, we might be doing a live show of it, which will also be a kind of workshop and lab for people who are games players. Like, young kids love it because it looks much, you know, it looks more like a computer game than it does something about history. That's part of its trick. Yeah, and it will, whether you hate it or love it, it will definitely have an impact on you.
Chris certainly doesn't hate it, do you, Chris?
I loved it. Yeah, I've seen it twice, and I found it really, really inspirational, amazing, and very touching. Totally. So Lydia,
could I just like to say, what's been wonderful, and it's quite sad, but you know, I would like to thank Den Birchmore, Jean Birchmore, and also Den's granddaughter Emily, who took part in the filming of the artwork, and his whole family, to thank them, and also to make the Airship Dreams Escaping Gravity in memory of Den, because he was a wonderful man. He was very passionate about airships, and I hope he certainly inspired me to be more passionate about airships, and I hope he will continue to do that for the community, even though
finally I've got to thank my collaborators Roland Denning, Roger Illingworth, Dave Lynch, Rob Strachan, and Sam Weil, who are the co-producers of Escaping Gravity with myself. And of course, the Arts Council, who put up most of the funding with the Heritage, the National Heritage Trust, and Bedford Creative Arts, who produced it.
Excellent, thank you. So Lydia, can you please give us the website address and any social media that you have, so our listeners can research this and look into it further, and please visit Bedford.
Sure. So you can find information at airshipdreams.com, and you can also find it at www.thehigginsbedford.org.uk as well. Those two places.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Mike and Lydia. That has been great. It's been really, really lovely hearing about something that is just different. You know, we've done loads of boaty stuff. We've done loads of fighty stuff. But actually, kind of, this is a bit of a sadness tinge, but also really, really interesting piece of history. And it's been a pleasure having you on. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.